Grab your favorite mug and fill it up with your favorite blend, because we're getting ready to sit down and talk about Southwest Florida real estate. Cottrell Title and Escrow presents The Closing Experience, real estate talk over a cup of coffee. What are my closing fees going to be? Should I rent or should I finally purchase? Why do I have to send all of these documents to get a mortgage? The real estate process doesn't have to be frustrating. Let our experts at Cottrell Title and Escrow help make buying or selling real estate a dream. Here to answer all of your questions, our host, managing partner of Cottrell Title and Escrow, James Schlimmer.
All right, it's 12 noon. We're here, Cottrell Title and Escrow, bringing you another wonderful, wonderful webinar here, The Closing Experience, where I'm super excited about this one. And I say this about every single topic that we do, but, you know, news brief. There's about a thousand people moving to Florida every single day right now. So this topic couldn't be more timely, I guess is a better way to say it. So first, let me introduce the lovely attorneys of Grant Cottrell Miller Myers. You can see Mr. Justin Cottrell.
Hi, everybody.
And you can see the lovely Aaron Miller Myers. I think it's the first one that I say.
Lovely. That's fine.
Well, that's nice of you, Aaron.
Yeah. You guys are lovely. I would ask that the folks, if you could in the chat, if you can just make sure that you can hear Justin and you can hear Aaron, just let me know. That'd be wonderful. And as far as questions go, there's a Q&A button right at the bottom of the screen. Feel free to press that button, or you can use the chat. If you are listening, which believe it or not, newsflash, second newsflash, of the more people listen on podcasts than actually attend the webinar or watch the video. So if you're listening in your car, we advise you to buckle up, make sure that you use your blinker, and enjoy the sweet, sweet melodies of Justin Cottrell and Aaron Miller Myers. Take it away, guys.
Wow. That was quite the intro.
Very.
Okay. So we're going to be talking about Homestead. You know, we've got the five W's of Homestead in Florida. We're going to go through our agenda. So while I am sharing our screen, I want Justin to any preliminary remarks before we jump into the slides?
Nope. For the mirror marks.
Okay.
We're good.
Right, we're going to cover a lot of information in a very short time period. So let's.
But you guys are surprised by that 1,000 people a day are moving here. I mean, that's huge.
It's exciting.
Good talk.
It's great. All right. So we're going to talk about who's entitled to Homestead in Florida. What are their Homestead benefits? When and where do owners file for Homestead? Why might Homestead status affect your closing, and how can we assist our clients in establishing domicile here in Florida? So the first is, who is entitled to Homestead here in Florida? Justin, who can do that?
Well, so let's unpack that question a bit for a second. So let's first talk about there's different types of Homestead in Florida here. and it often gets pretty confusing here when we're dealing with, what are we referring to? What are we actually referring to when we talk about Homestead? A lot of people think it's just the county tax exemption and the Save Our Homes and different things like that. But it's also more than that. It's also the constitutional protection against creditors on your house as well. And then the third thing when we talk about Homestead is the constitutional or statutory, requirements of or restriction on devises.
Okay.
Meaning that if me and my spouse own property as our homestead, neither one of us could alienate ourselves from that property or sell that property without the
spouse joining.
So those are three different things. So when we talk about here, who is entitled to Homestead in Florida, we are referring to just for the county tax portion of it here, correct?
Yes, in this section, yes.
Yeah, in this section. So who is entitled? So now, back to the slide. Someone, you have to have made Florida your domicile, homestead. So physically present here, own the piece of property prior to the December 31st of the previous year.
Okay.
So that's one.
Okay.
Right? So it's this owner of real property who are their permanent residents.
Anyone who closed their transaction in 2020 and who intends to make Florida their homestead and avail themselves of the homestead tax benefits, they ought to reside in the property by December 31st, 2020. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay.
They must be physically present there with the intent of making it their permanent domicile.
Okay.
There can only be one homestead per family unit. And then a married couple owning properties is entitled to only one homestead exemption.
Okay.
So this was your slide here. So you're confident about that, though. So you're not. So if someone lives in New York, husband lives in New York, wife lives in Florida, they're not able to claim homestead in both those
states. I'm reasonably confident.
I am too. Yeah. I just want to.
Yeah. I don't know of any state that's made any exception. Yep. So ultimately, if you plan on claiming Florida as your primary residence, please don't also try to avail yourself of the homestead tax benefits in Chicago.
That's correct.
Or New York.
And we'll go over this in a second. The declaration of domicile, though, you're swearing under oath essentially that you're giving up your homestead exemption elsewhere. Yep, in other states. So, okay. What are the benefits of homestead? One, we have it provides owners with an exemption of taxes, and that is the $25,000 per spouse reduction of your taxable value. Correct?
Okay. All right.
There's a question mark behind there. Is that accurate?
$25,000,
so $50,000 for husband and wife and $25,000 for one.
Up to a certain amount of consideration. Yes.
The next thing that it protects, as you spoke about before, constitutional homestead protection protects your house from for sales by creditors.
Okay.
So in general, if somebody sues you, and they get a judgment.
Against
you individually.
Yep. Okay.
They get a judgment against you. You owe them money. They record that judgment in the public records in any county in Florida. That judgment attaches, is a lien essentially against all non-homestead property.
Okay.
So if it is your homestead, that judgment does not attach to that property. They cannot foreclose on that judgment. You do not need to satisfy that judgment in the event you sell that property. So that's a huge creditor protection thing. In Florida, your home truly is your castle. Nobody can take it from you. Very few other states have an unlimited homestead protection. I think Texas is the only one that's unlimited. Most other states have like $100,000 protection or different things like that. Florida is completely unlimited.
Okay. That's not to say that if you do sell your property and there's a judgment that is against you, that you might not have to take additional steps to show that this property was, in fact, that your homestead. So we'll talk about the notice of homestead a little bit later. All right. And the third?
Yeah, sure. Well, we referred to before that it places restrictions on devising your homestead. Again, husband and wife own property. That's their homestead. They cannot devise it to somebody without both people actually conveying it. Where this really comes into play is what we see in different people's estate plans. So what you can't do while you're alive, you also cannot do after you pass away. So we see a lot of people who might have their homestead in one spouse's name and having that homestead maybe devised to a trust that doesn't give their surviving spouse full lifetime benefits of that, and then that'll be an improper alienation of that property. So that can raise some issues beyond the scope of this conversation today, but we have to be careful anytime we're selling or devising our homestead to make sure that both spouses are giving up their rights in that interest.
Okay. And the same applies to mortgages as well. So I'm sure all of our agents who have had one spouse be the buyer on a piece of property, the buyer wants to they're married, they want to take title in their name only, and then we find out a week before closing, oh, by the way, the buyer is married, yep, and this property will be their homestead property. So though the spouse is not going to be necessarily entitled to the property, they're not necessarily going to be on the deed, because they are a spouse, they'll need to be joining in signing the mortgage, the security instrument that encumbers that homestead property. So the wife or spouse doesn't need to necessarily join in signing the promissory note or really any of the other lender documents, but they would certainly need to join in signing the mortgage for the same reason that the spouse would need to join in signing the deed to convey away that interest.
That's a great point.
Thanks.
Great point. Good job. So what's next? What are the benefits of homestead?
Yep.
You want to go through this?
Sure. So this is the tax benefit. So we're talking about providing the owner with the exemption from property taxes. This is under a different area of the Florida Constitution, but it's a $25,000 exemption on the first $50,000 of assessed value and an additional $25,000 exemption on the assessed value between $50,000 and $75,000. In order to receive both exemptions, again, that $50,000 exemption, the assessed value of the property must be greater than $75,000.
Okay.
I didn't see a spousal distinction, so I...
Gotcha.
Yep. Okay. So other benefits of homestead, we're talking about save our homes, that it limits the increases of the assessed value of the qualified homestead property to 3% or the CPI, whichever is less from 1 year to the next. So you can explain that. Why do we have the save our homes?
So the big picture is this, is that people, let's just say somebody bought their house for $200,000 and then 10, 15 years later, they sell that house for $700,000 or $800,000. Generally, one of the benefits of the county tax homestead provision is that your taxable value of the property can only increase so much every year, and it's 3% a year. So in the event that it increases much more, you're not essentially forced to pay that amount. What we don't want to do is have families who buy a place for $200,000, and just because everything else goes up in value around them, that their taxes shoot up proportional to that necessarily, so that they can no longer afford to stay in that place. They bought the place for $200,000. They budgeted, let's just say you have an elderly couple, they budgeted to spend taxes based on that $200,000. We don't want to force them to have to move out of their house just because the taxes go up. So that's the public policy reason behind that. Now, to take that, the next step is often people would then sell their house and then move to an equivalent house or maybe upgrade or whatnot, and they would be hit with a huge tax increase. Again, they sell their house for $600,000 that they bought for $200,000, and they bought, let's just say, another $700,000 or $800,000 house, and there'd be this huge tax increase. And it'd be the difference between the $200,000 and the $800,000 that they just bought. Again, from a public policy standpoint, they're only increasing the value of their initial purchase, what they initially plan on spending, by 25%, yet their taxes are going up 75%. So that is the general idea of save our homes, that we're not going to hit them with that tax increase when they sell and buy a new homestead.
Also, so it doesn't affect, so if you buy your home 10 years ago and then the prices in your neighborhood shoot up,
sure,
that though the market value may be higher 10 years later,
yep,
you are not going to be priced out of your own neighborhood.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
And then we're going to talk about some examples of the portability benefits of that Save Our Homes benefit to new homesteaded property. So as you alluded,
yes,
to, when you move from one home to another and it is your homestead property, you're able to port over that Save Our Homes benefit. It could be reduced if the benefit is split between multiple homestead owners, and the maximum amount of the Save Our Homes assessment difference that can be transferred is $500,000.
Okay. So, and just to clarify, we were talking about two different things here before. Mm-hmm. We were talking about the Save Our Homes, which means your value can only increase 3% every year, and then the portability function, meaning that you can move from one to the next.
Yep.
So portability, is that what we're on right now?
We're on portability.
Okay, so we're giving an example here with portability here. So in this example, the screen that's showing right now, they bought their house, or in 2013, the house was worth $400,000. The capped assessed value was $250,000.
Okay.
So in this example, they presumably, let's just forget about the 3%. So they bought their home for $250,000, right?
Okay.
Is that why it would, well, no, because they, is this, in this example, they bought it for $250,000 and it's gone up to $400,000 in 2013. Is that what we're talking about in this
that,
example?
We'll assume that.
Okay, cool. Which means that the capped assessed value is $250,000 because they paid $250,000 for it. And the Save Our Home portion is only $150,000.
Okay.
The difference between the two.
Okay. Yes. Correct.
So now in 2014, it's worth $500,000.
You're buying a new home for $500,000.
Buying a new home for $500,000.
Correct.
Selling old home.
Yep.
Buying a new home.
Right.
Because of the difference. So the real question is now, what will the value of the new home that I just purchased at $500,000, what will the taxable value be at that point? And what we do is we take the value of the new home that we purchased and we subtract the Save Our Home portions from the previous house that we owned. Because the previous house that we owned, the fair market value was $400,000 and the taxable value was $250,000, meaning the Save Our Home values was $150,000. We take that $150,000, subtract it from the $500,000, the new home, and now we have a new taxable value of new home that we purchased for $500,000. The taxable value is only $350,000.
Right.
Did I do that math correct?
Yep. And if you did not port and you just established your new homestead, then the new home assessed value would be the $500,000.
Yep.
Yep.
On that note right there, I just want to say You are listening to the Closing Experience webinar series with the lovely attorneys of Grant Cottrell Miller Myers. If you are driving in your car on a podcast and you've never closed with Cottrell Title and Escrow, we would absolutely love the opportunity to earn your business. That's all I'm going to say about it. Back to the wonderful attorneys.
Thank you, James.
Thanks,
very
James.
Very lovely of you. Lovely, I guess, is the word of the day here.
Wonderful. Okay, so we went from a previous example from a home that was worth $400,000, upgraded to a home that's worth $500,000.
Yes.
Now we're going from a home that was $400,000, and we are downsizing
sure.
to a $300,000 property. So the math is a little bit different. But the idea is that you can still port, but you're not porting the actual value. You're porting a proportion of the taxable value.
Yes.
So in our second example here, we've got our market value of our home that exists as $400,000. Our capped assessed value is $250,000. So our Save Our Homes exempt value is $150,000. And then we buy a home, it's $300,000. What happens?
So what we're doing is we're taking the portion of that. And then the math with it is that we're taking the new assessed value of $300,000 and we're dividing it by $400,000.
Our new market value of 300 divided by $400,000. Yep.
Because, new market value of the house divided by old market value of the house times the capped assessed value of the previous house that we had before. This example would be $250,000. And that equals $187,500, which would be our new
assessed value.
Assessed value.
Yep. So that $300,000, since we were able to port from our previous home to our new home, our new assessed value is $187,000.
Without portability, it would be the $300,000.
Correct.
The fair market value of the home at that time. So that's significant. And from a tax standpoint, that essentially we're saving two-thirds or one-third of what it would be otherwise, a little bit more than one-third what it'd be otherwise. So,
yeah.
James, you got anything?
I'm just going to point out that everybody that's listening to this, obviously we have agents that are live that can actually see what you guys are presenting. After this, you can head over to fltitlegroup.com, click on the Closing Experience, the web series, and you'll be able to actually watch this. This is the first time, at least in the 8 years that we've been doing this, that I've seen somebody thoroughly go through and give such an in-depth explanation with hypos or examples, right? Where seeing it on the screen really, really is going to help. So I'm urging everybody to watch the video, because listening to what you guys are saying it's spot on, and getting a chance to see the example as well is helpful. So
sure. And we'll have the slides with the podcast, correct?
Correct. So they're already in the chat right now.
Perfect. Okay. We have a couple additional examples of, so if we're purchasing a more expensive home, again, the property appraiser's market value of the prior home being $285,000, the assessed value is $157,000. So the portable amount that you could port to the new Save Our Homes exempt value is $127,300. So our new home, the market value of our new home is $382,000. Once we port the Save Our Homes exempt value, our assessed value of the new home would be $254,700. We have a third example, but we're going to skip over because we've got a lot more to get through. But you do have the slides in your handouts, and if you have any questions, please give us a buzz. So we're going to talk a little bit more about the benefits of homestead regarding the protecting the homestead from for sale by creditors. So what kinds of liens are we talking about?
Mostly judgment liens, non-consensual. Okay. Really, the key is a non-consensual lien. So if you consent to give somebody a mortgage against your house, that the fact that it's homestead does not protect it from that creditor of foreclosing on that. And the most typical consensual lien that we're talking about is a mortgage that people give on their house, either a first or second mortgage or an equity line or different things like that. So
okay.
Those are
what if you don't pay your taxes? Can you lose your home?
Yeah, absolutely. So a tax is in first priority position. Florida homestead does not protect against tax liens at all.
Either. Okay. What if I have someone come out and install a roof in my home and I don't pay the contractor?
So per different statutory or statutes, Florida statutes, those type, for instance, a roof lien or any material mends, anything that you're actually adding to the value of the house would not be subject to the Florida constitutional homestead protections.
So I could lose my home if I don't pay for the roof,
that's correct.
Is what you're saying.
Yeah,
okay.
That's correct.
All right. So as we mentioned a little bit earlier, so while the judgment itself doesn't necessarily attach to the Florida homestead. So for title insurance purposes, if there is a judgment against a particular seller, they may be required to sign a homestead affidavit, or depending on the value of the judgment, or they may need to go through a process of filing a notice of homestead under Section 222.01 of the Florida statutes. And I've got one right now, actually. We've got to, we've got to file the notice of homestead. And the idea is that you're putting the creditor on notice that this person is intending to sell the property to a particular purchaser at a particular purchase price, and saying affirmatively that this homeowner is confirming that since they acquired the property, this has been their continuous uninterrupted homestead property, and so therefore the judgment could not have attached to this particular property. There is a 45-day notice provision in that. So if you're in a very quick timeline, you might need to have some creative solutions from a title insurance underwriter to be able to get the transaction to close on time if there is a notice of homestead, if it's a really particularly expensive judgment.
Sure, that or an aggressive creditor.
Or an aggressive creditor.
Yeah,
yep.
That's out there.
Yep. Okay, so we talked about the third, which is the placing the restrictions on a homestead owner from alienating or devising the homestead property. So when we're saying that when you die, you can leave your homestead property to anyone, so long as you're not survived by a spouse or a minor child. So the example is, of course, the husband holds title to the homestead property in his name only. He, as we discussed earlier, needs his wife's signature to sell or mortgage the property. Upon death, though, he can only devise to his spouse because it is his homestead property. Yeah?
Correct.
Cool. So we're going to talk about when and where folks can file for homestead tax benefits. So as Justin mentioned, if you purchased a property here in 2020 and you want to make this property your homestead property, you need to reside in the property by December 31st. Starting in January 1st, the applicant must be the owner of the resident of the Florida property and be a Florida a permanent Florida resident. You can use the warranty deed, your tax receipts as evidence of ownership of the property. And by March 1st, the application for homestead must be received by the property appraiser's office. So you actually, if you own the property in 2020, you move into the property, you make it your residence, then by March 1st, you must file your application for homestead through the property appraiser's office. So here in Collier County, applicants must file in person. They have to bring their certain documentation with them. In Lee County, the applicants can file in person, by mail, or online. We have copies of those applications in our handout documents. So we have there in your materials the contact information for Lee County Property Appraiser's Office, their phone number, their email address if you have any questions about exemptions, and their hours of operation, which I think are helpful. And in Lee County, so we've got a copy of their application. So some of the pieces of information that the property appraiser will look for is, of course, the proof of residence. So we want to know, when did you leave your prior residence? When did you move into your current residence? Do you give us your Florida driver's license or ID number? If there's any evidence of you relinquishing your Illinois driver's license, your Florida vehicle tag number, voter registration number, if you have one, declaration of domicile, if you filed one, your current employer, address on your last IRS tax return, school location. So essentially all of this information that you should have handy if Florida actually is your permanent residence.
So I have a client who just actually called me about this issue. They are closing on December, I think it's 22nd or 23rd.
Okay.
Moving from another state. And are they going to be able to get Florida domicile for this year? And we'll get into all those, what that actually means later on in this conversation. But the first part of this is, are they going to be able to claim Florida as their homestead from a county tax standpoint? And the answer is yeah, they could, but they're going to have to be hustling a lot because, first of all, they need to own the property prior to the end of the year. So they'll own the property on December 24th. Then they need to go get their driver's license here. They're not going to be able to get their driver's license until they own the property here. So they get their driver's license. Then they have to get the voter registration, then their car registration. And all these things need to be done sequentially. You can't do one. You can't get your car registration before you get your driver's license. You can't get your voter registration before you get your driver's license. So you can't do any of that until you actually purchase the property here. So so technically, can they claim Florida as their homestead or get homestead prior to or for 2021, yeah, technically they can. They're just going to have to do a lot of work, spend a lot of time over at the county area trying to get that done.
And I would suggest they make an appointment sooner rather than later.
Yes, oh, absolutely. An appointment. Sure,
yep,
sure.
Especially
sure.
with the holidays coming up.
100% to get
yep.
all that done.
Yep.
And I guess the big point of this is all this stuff needs to be done prior to, or should be done, prior to January 1st, so or December 31st. To claim that this was your homestead in or by the time January 1st came around. Even though the application's not due until March, mm-hmm. all this stuff needs to get done by the end of the year. Make sense?
Excellent point, yes. So you need to be able to show on January 1st, using all the documentation that you can provide,
yes.
that you had made as of January 1st, Florida, your homestead property.
Yep,
even though you've got a couple months to file the act. Collier County, you've got your appraiser's office locations. In Collier, we have what documents must be provided. So we went through some of the documentation for Lee County. In Collier County, you need evidence of your ownership, so the deed, the tax receipt, social security numbers, which are required by Florida statute, which is very interesting. So social security numbers for all the applicants. Collier County voter registration dated prior to January 1st. Florida driver's license dated prior to January 1st. Florida vehicle sure. registration dated prior to January 1st of that year. And then, of course, optional is the declaration of domicile that can be filed, but again, filed prior to January 1st of the year of application.
Why do you find it interesting?
I don't know. I just find it interesting.
Yeah.
I just find it interesting. So, additionally,
interesting that you find it interesting.
I find it very interesting. So, additional information, if they're not a U.S. citizen, then a resident alien green card may be needed to provide to the Collier Appraiser's Office. If the property is held in trust, Collier Appraiser may require a complete copy of the trust agreement, or if you have an attorney working with you, they can pull out some of the pages that they think the appraiser will need rather than give the entire trust agreement.
To that point, we often get phone calls after we've placed property into trust, homestead property into trust, saying that we have a letter from the county appraisal's office saying that we need to provide them a copy of the trust to make sure that this mm-hmm. property can still qualify for that that person's homestead. This is something that you can almost expect, and generally we just call them up and we email them over certain pages. It's really not a problem at all, but it's something that happens often. It used to not happen very often. We used to be able to put on the deed that the property still qualified for homestead, and that was enough, but now most of the time we're going to have to send over trust pages to the appraisal office in order to get that qualified. So
perfect. If the residence is a mobile home, we'll also need the real property decal number and the copy of the registration or title of the mobile home. And then also, if the applicant or their spouse benefited from residency-based exemption in an out-of-state property, meaning your mm-hmm. up north home in Chicago, they needed a document from that government office stating that the exemption has been removed from the up north home.
Interesting. That's just Collier.
That's what it says, just Collier.
Cool.
Yeah. So why might homestead status affect our closing?
Let me run with this.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm not sure if it would affect the closing, but what we need to know for a buyer of property on here, right? So in the, well, I guess it would affect the closing. In the NABOR and FARBOR contracts, they have certain expenses to be prorated. And let's just, for example, say buyer buys house for $300,000 5 years ago. That house is now selling for $750,000. It's only going to be taxed on the purchase price, not the fair market value of the house itself. So we're going to be prorating the taxes based upon the current tax bill that's out there, not based upon the new market value. And presumably those taxes are going to go way up for the
following year.
For the following year for that purchaser, mm-hmm. unless there's some type of portability or a different thing for that buyer. So why it affects closings is because buyers need to realize their taxes are likely going to adjust to the fair market value, not the taxable value of it currently.
Mm-hmm.
And the proration themselves will be a little bit, I guess it will be based upon the previous year's value, not this current year.
Okay, yes. So let's say that the homeowner who is selling the property enjoys the benefits of the homestead exemption. Mm-hmm. At closing, when the taxes are prorated in the settlement statement, seller will be providing, for example, a credit to the buyer for the January 1st taxes through the date of closing. Buyer takes that credit and knows that when the tax bill comes out in November, the buyer is going to be paying that tax bill. But if the property was still the homestead of the owner as of January 1st of the year of closing, the buyer, whether or not it's the buyer's homestead, will be benefiting from that homestead exemption, and the taxes will be based on that. If the taxes are significantly different from the estimated taxes based at closing, either party in both Zabor and Farber contracts, either party could request a reproration of the tax prorations. So,
When would that be? When would that happen?
Last month.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. So in November, when the tax bill comes out, it is the seller or the buyer could say, "Wait a minute, I'm looking at my the settlement statement. You only prorated based on the previous year's taxes. Let's say the homestead status changed from last year to this year, and now the taxes are significantly higher or significantly lower."
Sure.
So then the parties could request a reproration. Typically that's done between the parties, but sometimes they'll go through the closing agent to contact the other party to request the reproration. Both parties have that language in their contracts.
We rarely see it exercised.
Yep, just a few times, and we've had some folks say, "Well, can I get around it?" And I think I don't see how someone can get around it because they contracted to it, and in the sales contract it says that the provision will survive closing. So buyer and seller both agreed that they will reprorate if the taxes are significantly different. Also, just a note: if you are have a client who's buying new construction and the taxes were based on the vacant land. So let's say the home was CO'd in the year 2020, but the tax prorations were based on the vacant land as the property existed on January 1st of 2020. Just know that the taxes will go up. They will not go down. They will go up based on the value of the land plus the improvements for the following year. And, something to be prepared for.
Just want to throw out that if anybody has any questions who's live in the webinar, feel free to use the Q&A button at the bottom of the screen or the chat, and I'll make sure those questions get right over to Mr. Justin Cottrell and Aaron Miller Myers.
Thanks
so much.
Wonderful. Okay, so we have a hypo. So Bobby buys a new Florida home for $400,000 in July and makes it his permanent residence. When the tax bill comes out in November in the year of closing, July 2020, does it reflect the prior owner's homestead exemptions? The answer is
yes.
So then Bobby himself, he applies for the homestead tax exemption prior to March 1st. How does this affect Bobby's property tax bill for the year after closing?
2021.
Yes.
It'll be reduced by the
exemption amount.
The exemption amount, yes. And subject to the state of our homes. So it will not increase. The property value, market value would not increase.
Yep. Cool.
From the previous year.
All right. Why else might a homestead status affect our closing? So we have, we talked about the joinder of spouse issues on the deed and the contract conveying homestead properties. Mm-hmm. We all know that the deed needs to be joined by the spouse, but sometimes the contract is only in Mr. Seller's name. Mr. Seller is married. It's their homestead property. And maybe Mrs. Seller isn't included in the contract. She's not consulted about anything. And she may not be willing to sign the deed if she wasn't even consulted about the sale of the property. So if you know that this is the client's homestead property and you know that your client is married, and even though title to the property may be in just Mr. Seller's name, have Mrs. Seller join on the sales contract so that we know that they're both on the same page as to conveying their homestead property. We talked about the joinder of spouse on a mortgage encumbering the homestead property. Again, even if only one spouse is entitled to the property, if there's any chance that this could possibly be their homestead property, the second spouse will need to join in signing. Now, there is an exception that title companies will allow sometimes, maybe if it's an investment property and the husband and wife sign an affidavit saying that there's no way in the world that this property could ever possibly potentially become their homestead property. Our homestead property is in Chicago, for example. On a case-by-case basis, the title company or their underwriter may accept that kind of document. But if the husband and wife are going to go ahead and sign an affidavit, they might as well just both sign the mortgage.
Sure.
And no problems. And the joinder by the beneficiary under trust who is using the property as homestead. So let's say I have property in trust. Justin, you're my trustee, but I'm the beneficiary of the property, and I'm using this property as my homestead. So if you enter into a sales contract to sell the property on my behalf, and this is my homestead property, do I need to join in signing the deed? You're trying to convey away my homestead property.
And I'm your trustee.
You're my trustee. You know. Yes. So just know that if you have, you know, a trustee of a trust, and it doesn't appear to be the beneficiary of the trust, and it is somebody's homestead, so we know, you know, Aunt Sally's using this property as her homestead, but she just doesn't want to deal with the trust stuff. She has Justin Cottrell as the trustee of the trust. Just know that Justin will need Sally to join in signing the deed to convey away her homestead interest as a beneficiary. Okay, so why on earth would residents of other states want to establish a Florida domicile, Justin?
Sure. So this is something we get constantly, and I'd imagine you guys get a lot too. Your clients from Chicago or Illinois, New York, any Midwestern or Northeastern state out there, and they decide, you know what, we're going to make Florida our domicile, our residence, our homestead. How do we do that? We get the question a lot. I imagine you guys do a lot. So the first question is, why do they want to do that? And the main reason why is this, is they don't want to pay income taxes on their passive income. So we're all very familiar with federal income taxes, and that's, you know, you have to pay taxes to the federal government. But most people have to also pay a state income tax. And the way state income taxes work is that in the event that you actually are physically present in another state while you're employed, I guess, you have to pay state income taxes in that state. You see often athletes, they have to file, when they file their income tax returns, they have to file income tax returns for every state that they've ever played in, because if they played a game in that state, they need to pay taxes for their prorated amount there. So anytime you're actually in a state working, you need to pay income taxes based upon that state's income tax rate. Now, when you have what's called passive income as opposed to active income, and that's your interest, your dividends, all of the things that you earn money on while not actively working, that is going to be taxed in the state that you are a resident in. So if you live in New York and you have all your interest income, you have your dividend income, that is going to be taxed in New York so long as you're living there. However, if you move your residence down to Florida, all your passive income will now be not subject to any state's tax rate. So that's why people will want to move down to Florida at the end of the day, is for income tax and inheritance tax. When they die, a lot of states have inheritance tax. Florida does not as well. So that's the main reason why people want to get Florida set up as their domicile.
We're going to talk about the state income tax rates. I've got a little chart here showing how Florida does not have the state income tax, and we can compare it to other states where you've got some higher. And this is maybe a little bit outdated. I think some of these tax rates might have increased a bit. But, again, state estate and death tax rates we've got in our chart. So in your handouts, you can review that. So we're going to talk about what is domicile.
Sure. So then the question is that everybody gets asked, how do I make Florida my domicile? The key here, more than anything, is it's not the actions that you actually take to make Florida your domicile. It's more the actions you take to abandon your previous domicile. Because again, Florida doesn't care whether you claim them as your domicile or not. They're not taxing you either way. It's the state of Illinois who is all of a sudden not getting a tax return from you, who's going to care, and you need to show what you've done in order to divorce or abandon your previous domicile. So from a technical standpoint, the two elements of domicile in Florida, one is physical presence. You have to be here. So you have to buy your place, your house prior to December 31st of the previous year, and then actually physically be here the majority of the year. The next element is intent, and that you have to not only physically be here, but intend to make this place your permanent residence. And with intent, that is all the where all the subjectivity comes in. That's a very difficult thing to measure, and we generally have a list of facts and circumstances that measure intent. This next slide, it states, the test of intent with respect to purported new domicile has been stated as, whether the place of habitation is a permanent home of that person with the range of sentiment, feeling, and permanent association with it. I don't think that definition actually adds any clarity. Again, it's just more words on what is somebody's intent. So let's go back down to the next slide. And if you see the bold words there, and I think this is very, very important to point out. Illinois comes and they audit you and they say, what are we doing? What have you done? Or why are you not paying me state income taxes right now? It's the person who's moved. It's their burden of proof. They're the ones who have to actually prove that they have abandoned their previous domicile. The state does not have to prove that you have not done that. You have to prove that you have actually done that. And there's a number of factors that the courts will look at as to whether that has been abandoned or not.
So if I'm moving from California to Florida and I want to escape the taxes in California, I'm going to be the one having the burden of proof to show California, no, I abandoned California. Yep. I have now made Florida my homestead.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And again, it's when challenged, the issue is not the steps an individual has taken to become a Florida resident, but rather the steps an individual has taken to divorce or abandon themselves from their previous state of residency. And that's your burden to prove to them this other state.
Okay. So some of those things could be the same type of things that we do to prove our Florida homestead. So getting a driver's license, voter registration, having a home here, actually residing in the home here in Florida.
Yes. And I think we have a slide coming up with all the facts and circumstances that generally we'll look at.
Yep, factors and proof of abandoning the residency of a previous state.
Exactly. So the first one is physical presence. Then we have filing the declaration of domicile, which we talked about before. We have filing for the homestead exemption. Again, there's not any one of these factors that are absolutely certain that, I've done this, and therefore I will be able to get Florida determined as my domicile. On the other hand, there's none of these that if I didn't do, I can't get Florida my domicile either. It's a facts and circumstances analysis. They take the whole, they look at all of these facts, all of these circumstances, and based upon the whole of it, do we determine whether or not you have taken the steps to divorce yourself or abandon the states.
And the folks that are making this judgment is not the Florida courts. It is the state where you abandoned. So if I move from California to Florida, California is going to look at all the facts and circumstances that the steps that I took and say, well, under California law, that was sufficient to abandon your California homestead or California domicile and establish it in Florida.
And again, this list is not exhaustive. There's so many different factors. For instance, what church now that you belong to, what doctor you're using, who your family therapist is, your dentist now. Here are some other factors here, where you file your tax return, the address that you put there, when did you change your driver's license, vehicle registrations, voter registration. Estate planning documents have been almost super factor in the in the tests that we've seen, both that and your tax return address on there. But estate planning documents in your last will and testament, when you've stated, John Doe, a resident of Collier County, Florida, or Minnesota, that has been almost a super factor that people have looked at or that states have looked at in determining whether or not somebody has changed their domicile. And I think we still have some.
So if you have a will, then you should update it.
The first, yes. Again, if you want to bring yourself under Florida domicile so that you're not paying taxes, especially if you're paying against, how much should somebody do or not do? This is super important. It's based upon what is their potential tax liability? If they're bringing in $5 million in passive gains every year, and it could be subject to a 10% state tax, so you're talking about $500,000 a year, then I would be checking off every single one of these things on this list to make sure that it's not a problem. Now, if only bring in $10,000 or $50,000 of passive income, and you're only talking about, $3,000 to $5,000 a year, then maybe it's not so important to go through every single one of these on the list. So we have, again, investment accounts, safety deposit box, family possessions. Where do you keep the family? If you have a family Bible, where do you keep that? If you have, different family jewelry, is that kept up in your northern house, or do you have a safety deposit or a place down here, and where you actually physically keep this? And then the next slide talks about how it more facts and circumstances professional. Have you hired a new CPA down here? Do you have a new estate planning attorney? Different things like that.
We do have a question.
Yep.
It says, it is widely believed that you must live in the homestead for 6 months and a day to keep your homestead. This is not true, correct?
That's correct. It's not true. It is a factor, though. So let's be very, that is a factor. None of these facts and circumstances would necessarily preclude you from having that. But what you do have to do is you need to live here more than any other place that you might have a residence at. So if you have three different places and you split time, you don't need to be here for, you know, over 6 months in a day, but you do need to be in this state more than any other state. I say you absolutely, I don't think it's an absolute factor. I think that might be a super factor that someone would look at. If you spend more time in any other place, it'd be presumably be your homestead. So
the idea is that you're spending more than 6 months away from where you came from.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
So the next slide I think is just that we're on right now, just some relevant case law. These are some cases that have been decided on whether or not somebody has abandoned their property. The first one we talked about with the Florida domicile, it was determined to be the Florida domicile, notwithstanding the fact that the license was still a North Dakota license, and his hunting license was that, and he spent 80% of the time in North Dakota, largely based on the declaration in his will that he was a Florida resident. So this is a case where someone spent more time outside of Florida than any other time, and the court still found that this person was a Florida resident. The next case states that the decedent determined to be a Pennsylvania domiciliary, notwithstanding a Florida homestead exemption, vehicle registrations, driver's license, bank accounts, address on final federal return. Again, largely based that in his will, that person stated that he was a Pennsylvania resident.
Wow.
I give these two cases again to show the importance of your estate planning documents on where you declare your domicile to be. So if there's a super factor, that is definitely one of the super factors that are here. The last one is a case in which they determined that his resident was actually in New York because he had an active business going on up there and he was constantly there with his active business, in spite of the fact that he had Florida registrations, license, and will declaration. So this is one that he did have the will declaration, and it did not actually that didn't win the day here, even when they had the driver's license and everything else, because he had an active business in New York that he was, up there and being a part of. The point of showing these cases more than anything is that there is no absolute right answer. There's no one or two, three, four, five, even 10 things that will 100% win the day for you. It's a total facts and circumstance analysis. The more important it is to you, the more facts and circumstances you should be checking off of this list.
You can be 100% certain, though, if folks are moving to Florida and they think, hey, the only thing I need to do to make this my domicile is just claim homestead tax exemption on the property and not do anything else, that may not work.
Sure. Upon audit of their previous state, yeah, it's certainly something. It certainly doesn't start and end there.
Anything else? No, just a note. So because this is so different between states, if you have a client, no matter where they're coming from, they may want to check with their estate planning attorney in the state from whence they come to make sure that they're doing what they need to do, not just to establish homestead here in Florida, establish their domicile here in Florida, but also to be able to prove that they have abandoned their domicile in the state that they come from. So a Florida attorney may not be able to say, these are the 10 things that you need to do to be able to, you know, abandon your domicile in California. We strongly encourage clients to talk with their up north counsel to be able to determine that. So
here's one of the things I'd say about this specific episode of The Closing Experience. We try to make content for you guys, the agents, one, to educate yourselves, but also to save you time. This is a perfect either podcast, or if they want to actually watch the webinar, tell your clients to go to fltitlegroup.com, look on the web series or look on the podcast. You can share it with them via text. Let them you know, you're just feeding up the information for them. It's a great touch for you to be able to check back in if they're getting ready to make an offer. But please use this content to help further your discussions. Yeah. This is a great one for it.
Yeah. I think that's all we've got. We'll be back after the new year
with
some new content. If you guys have any topics you'd like for us to discuss, please send us an email or send James a little chat, and we'll go from there.
Please do. Thanks. We're looking forward to see you guys after the first of the year. Have a great Thanksgiving and a happy holidays.
Thanks, everyone.
We're off.
Wonderful.
Thank you, guys.
We have a meeting today.